You'll hear arguments next in 1058 Central Illinois Public Service against the United States. This is why we ought to have the final tax court sometime. Well, we don't have that. We don't take all that many of them.
We don't have more than a year.
Ms. King, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case, unlike the prior case, does not present an income tax question. It's a withholding tax case. It involves the scope of the withholding tax provisions and primarily the definition of the term wages. An item is not subject to withholding unless it's a wage within the meaning of the statute. The facts in this case are basically agreed upon. The petitioner, a public utility company, reimbursed its employees in the year 1963 for expenses which they incurred in traveling on required trips on the company's business. The petitioner used the same method of reimbursement. It reimbursed on the same basis for overnight and non-overnight trips. The government's contention is that petitioner should have withheld on the reimbursement payments which were made to employees for meal expenses incurred on non-overnight trips. There's no question that withholding is required on any of the other reimbursement payments.
That is, there's no question it's not required.
That's correct, yes. The district court held for petitioner. It concluded that the government's requirement of withholding on the non-overnight trip meal reimbursements was a departure from the realities of business life and a vigorous stretching of the statute. The Seventh Circuit reversed, and in reversing held in effect that virtually every item arising out of the employment relationship should be included in the withholding base and should be subject to withholding.
Ms. King, let me ask a question or two, if I may. We're concerned here with 1963 liability, aren't we?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that mean that we have the same issue up for every year since that time, 14 years?
There are prospective years. They are not before the court.
Is there any claimed element of bad faith in this case?
No.
Has the government attempted to tax these items to the individual employees, so far as you know?
Yes, it has.
Successfully?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the Aarons case is a case which involves one of the petitioner's employees. The employee Aarons paid the tax and then sued for a refund, questioning whether he had an offsetting income tax deduction. In the years prior to this case, the government did pursue the employees, but it's obviously much easier to pursue the employer, and that's why the change in 1963.
Well, is the judicial reaction uniformly that it is income subject to tax to the employee?
Every item of reimbursement is deemed to fall within the broad definition of gross income, but there is an offsetting deduction for these items so that the effect is, and it's generally considered, that these items are not income, but they are treated as taxable income and then subject to an offsetting income tax deduction.
Under Illinois law, if you lose here, would your client have a claim for restitution against the employees from whose wages it didn't deduct these amounts?
I suppose it would have a claim, but as a practical matter, it would just be
kind
impossible
of a theoretical
to pursue
one, yeah.
All these people. If the withholding statute is interpreted as the Seventh Circuit interpreted and as the government contends here to include every economic benefit arising out of the employment relationship, the effect will be that almost every employer in this country will be in violation of the withholding tax provisions.
Do you understand the government's claim to be as broad as you've just characterized it?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, on page 20 of their brief, in the second full paragraph, the last sentence, the government says the statutory concept of wages is not tied to the performance of any particular service, but includes any personal economic benefit given by an employer to his employee as a result of the employment relationship.
You think that would mean that employees who work in an office and the office is heated would have to pay for their share of the heat?
That's a possible interpretation if we're talking about every economic benefit. If every economic benefit is included, the problems are enormous. First of all, identifying what is in the withholding base, such as heating and air conditioning and comfortable offices.
Telephones.
After identifying them, there are valuation problems where there are non-cash items involved, and there are all sorts of problems in determining whether the regulations which exclude or exempt items from the definition of wages are still applicable.
Well, I suppose, since it would be pretty difficult to handle the accounting on charging people for the amount of heat that they absorbed or the light that they used, let me give you a more concrete one for you. Suppose it would include a Thanksgiving turkey, so that if the employer gave a Thanksgiving turkey to every employee that was worth $20, I suppose, these days, he would have to withhold from their paycheck whatever is the tax on $20.
That's right. There is an exemption or an exclusion under the regulations now for facilities and services, that is, courtesy discounts or a medical center or related things. But, of course, if every economic benefit is included, it does raise a question on what the effect of that regulation might be.
There are specific, I guess perhaps not a statute, but regulations with respect to bonuses, aren't there?
Yes.
Both in cash and in kind.
Of even greater significance, there is a regulation with respect to reimbursements for travel expenses. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to say that in both the lower courts held that the amounts here involved are reimbursements for legitimate travel expenses. That's not a fact question. And this regulation is so important to this case, I would like to read it. It's on page 12 of our opening brief, which is the blue-covered brief. It's at the top of that page. It says, traveling and other expenses, amounts paid specifically, either as advances or reimbursements, for traveling or other bona fide, ordinary, and necessary expenses incurred or reasonably expected to be incurred in the business of the employer are not wages and are not subject to withholding. We think this regulation should dispose of this case. The government does not challenge the validity of the regulation.
It's the government's regulation.
Yes, it is. And it has been in the regulations since the early 1940s, when the present withholding tax provisions were adopted. Present withholding tax provisions were adopted in 1942 and 1943, and this came in 1943, and it's been there ever since. The government contends, though, that this regulation should be read to apply only to reimbursements or allowances where the employee is not entitled to an offsetting business deduction. But there is nothing in the regulation that says that. The government does point to the ordinary and necessary language, which it says refers back to Section 162 and the employee's deduction. But Section 162 applies to employers as well as it applies to employees. And further, these regulations are written for employers. It's the employer's obligation to withhold, which is involved. And so they're in terms of, as this regulation says, amounts paid as advances or reimbursements, not amounts received, and ordinary and necessary expenses incurred or reasonably expected to be incurred in the business of the employer, not the business of the employee. And as Mr. Smith said earlier, those are two different things. The government in this case has essentially...
Ms. King, may I interrupt just to be sure I follow this argument? Is this the regulation that provides the authority for excluding the amounts paid on overnight trips from wages?
This regulation applies to exclude... if you're talking about the Corral case,
No, I'm talking about your company's practice of not including in wages. You don't include them whether they're overnight or not.
That's correct.
The government agrees that you properly exclude the reimbursements insofar as they relate to overnight trips.
Right.
Yes.
And is the reason they agree that that is proper based on this regulation?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, then doesn't your questioning about the difference between employer and employee equally raise a question about that practice?
Well, I think that if I understand your question correctly, this regulation is significant because it uses the word traveling. It doesn't use the words travel away from home. The employee's deduction under Section 162 is based on language allowing him a deduction for travel away from home.
The statute doesn't say anything about that.
No, the withholding statute says nothing.
No, nor does does any other statute say.
That's correct.
162 doesn't say anything about that.
Yes, it says travel away from home. Section 162 does.
Well, away from home, but nothing about overnight.
No, but this court in Corral interpreted the away from home language to mean away from home overnight. But the
over substantial dissent.
it's true of a large percentage of the decisions of this court.
But the away from home concept is not incorporated in these regulations. And this is, I think, is of particular significance because the government claims that its overnight theory was established just about the time, about 3 years prior to the time this regulation was issued.
Well, isn't the issue whether the overnight concept is incorporated in this regulation? Isn't that the very thing we have to decide?
Well, I think the issue is, that's what brings the case to this court, but I think the issue is broader than that, and that is that if travel expense reimbursements are included in the withholding base because of the theory that every economic benefit arising out of the employment relationship should be treated as a wage subject to withholding, that is really the question which is involved. And that was the basis for the Seventh Circuit's holding.
Well, perhaps they should have written a narrower opinion, but that's perhaps that doesn't really dispositive of the question how you decide the case, is it?
That, I think that is the Seventh Circuit's view, and that's the view which the government is espousing here. But there is nothing in the withholding provisions which draw a distinction between overnight and non-overnight. And I would like to go on and say that the government arrives at its theory by attempting an equivalence between the broad definition of gross income in the income tax provisions and the more narrow term wages in the withholding tax provision. It does this, although the word income does not appear in the withholding tax statute. At one time, many years ago, when one of the initial withholding tax statutes was adopted, this was in the tariff of 1913, Congress did try for an all-inclusive withholding provision. And in that provision, among other things, they included all annual gains, profits, and income. As it turned out, the Department of the Treasury was soon back to Congress saying, we're having difficulty with collections, and furthermore, those that are made are erroneous and excessive, and it's causing us a great burden. So in 1942, when the present withholding system was adopted, Congress still had the option to go to income, but it did not. It went to the term wages.
Ms. King, at the outset, you made a point of emphasizing that, unlike the previous case, this was not an income tax case. This is a withholding tax case.
Yes.
Does that, may I properly infer from that point that you so emphasized that even if you prevail, and even, therefore, if your client need not withhold these payments, they may nonetheless be income to the employees?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Or put another way, wages may not mean the same as income.
That is correct. And as a matter of fact, the government's own rulings have so said.
Well, the statute says so.
And the 61. Statute so says.
Income includes wages, among many other things.
Yes, that they are not synonymous terms. The government, in a number of rulings, has found in various situations that an employee may have an income result from a payment he receives, but the employer does not have a withholding obligation. And the uniform decided cases up to the Seventh Circuit's decision below in the Court of Claims and two circuit courts have held that the income tax treatment to the employee is immaterial in determining the scope of the withholding tax provisions. And I think it's also significant that while the government places considerable emphasis on this court's decision in the LeBeau case in 1956, which was a gross income case, it did not consider withholding. The rulings which the government issued saying that just because there's an item of income doesn't mean the employer must withhold came, for the most part, after that decision was issued. So they're obviously they're well aware that what the gross income sections say does not influence what the withholding tax provisions are. The government does cite a decision of this court, the Naratko case, in 1946, which does involve withholding, and I think it deserves special mention. That case involved the question of whether Social Security tax withholding was required on an award of back pay to improperly discharged employees, and the court held that it was. But back pay is not the same as remuneration for a travel expense as a payment of a travel expense reimbursement. And as a matter of fact, in the Social Security regulations, there is a provision such as the one I read earlier on travel expense reimbursements. It is identical today. It was substantially the same in 1946, saying that reimbursements are not wages subject to withholding. Obviously, this court's decision on the back pay question was not intended to overrule that regulation and did not do so. That regulation continues to have force and effect. The government has somewhat modified its pure equivalence argument between income and wages by contending that the equivalence doesn't apply if the employee is entitled to an offsetting income tax deduction. It's not clear how the government finds support for this in its withholding provisions. It's not there. It's also not clear how the government thinks this system would work. It suggests that every employee would take on the burden of determining what the income tax deductions of each of its employees is likely to be, and not on a payment-by-payment basis, but it would look on an aggregate basis for the entire year and try to take into account trips which might arise based on unforeseeable events in the company's business. It might have to take in all sorts of considerations, but the point is that it would be up to the employer to somehow decide what the income tax deductions would be for each of its many employees. And for an employer such as the petitioner with thousands of employees, this is simply an administrative nightmare. So basically, the point we want to make is that the government, in arguing the income tax cases, has confused the issue here. It's not an income tax case. It's a withholding tax case, and the withholding tax provisions must govern. And we believe that the withholding tax provisions are quite clear, that Congress intended that wages be a narrow term, and furthermore, the regulations which have been in, which have been on the books since the very outset of the withholding provisions, preclude the inclusion in the withholding base of reimbursements for legitimate travel expenses. There is a second issue in this case, which involves the question of whether a change in an administrative view about the withholding tax provisions can be imposed retroactively against an employer. In 1963, when these payments were made, there was not one regulation or ruling or court case which would have suggested that these reimbursement payments were subject to the withholding tax. And as a matter of fact, the regulation said quite the contrary. The government seems to concede in its brief that if there is a factual or legal basis on which an employer that withholding was not required, it is then an abuse of discretion to retroactively impose withholding on the employer. And we believe this is clearly this case. It would be an abuse to retroactively impose a withholding requirement. The employer, after all, acts only as an agent for the government. This does not involve the employer's tax. It's merely collecting taxes to assist the government.
May I ask when you think the government put taxpayers fairly on notice as to its policy? What year?
Well, I think that probably the first published announcement came in 1969 in its revenue ruling 69592. And in that revenue ruling, the government said that if an employer reasonably believes at the time he makes a payment that the employee's offsetting deductions will equal or exceed for the entire year the amount of the reimbursements which he will receive, then withholding is not required.
Now that's pretty good tax lawyer to understand what that means.
Yes, it does.
You think the small businessman with no tax lawyer would ever understand that?
I think it would be very difficult for any small business without having sophisticated tax advice to know what that meant.
Correll, do you think that constituted notice?
No, I don't. The Correll case was specifically an income tax case, and given the fact that and I might say that Correll was never asked to consider the withholding tax provisions.
Right.
It never came up. But given the fact that even at the time the Correll case was decided, that there were these regulations, that there were the government's rulings, most of which were issued in the 1950s, at the time of, well, shortly after Correll, there were a number of cases saying that the income tax treatment to the employee is immaterial. I think given all of that, that even sophisticated tax counsel would have been hard-pressed to have found a withholding obligation.
Until when? At least they learned the government's position. Until when?
Well, until they learned the government's position, I suppose, when this case began to come to the forefront, particularly now the district court decided for the petitioner, so it was really not until the Seventh Circuit
no later than the decision of the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit.
Yes. Right. But even then, it's such a broad opinion I expect that
It gives plenty of notice, at least to people in the Seventh Circuit, doesn't it?
Yes, but I don't know that every employer is out withholding on the air conditioning and the heating and so on. It's just impossible to administer.
Ms. King, but wouldn't the 1969 ruling have given notice to those who really understood it and read it carefully that there was this problem in this area?
The 1969 ruling never mentions wages. It doesn't talk in those terms. It's purely an administrative convenience-type ruling.
But it is talking about the obligation to withhold.
It does talk about the obligation to withhold.
And that obligation only applies to wages.
And that they don't talk about wages, but they just say
that obligation only applies to wages.
That's correct.
Statutory obligation.
Yes.
And doesn't it seem reasonable if they say you don't have to withhold if you expect the employee to have an offsetting deduction, that the converse is we do expect you to withhold if you don't think he does have an offsetting deduction?
Well, they didn't put it on a payment by payment basis. They said when you look at the aggregate of the payments which you think you might make to the employee over the period of a year, if you reasonably believe, for example, if you as an employer reimburse on the basis of 10 cents per mile for mileage and the deduction is 15, now gone to 17 cents a mile, then obviously there would be some excess deduction there which the employee would deduct against other items. But it puts an enormous administrative burden on employers.
Well, I'm not talking about the merits of whether it's wise. I understand your argument there. But just in terms of the notice point, your strongest argument, is it not, is for the period from 63 to 69. And of course, we have 63 here.
63 is the year before the court.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it seems to me after 69, you may or may not be able to make the same argument as all I was suggesting.
Well, we're addressing our argument to 63.
Right, yeah.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I think I would like to begin by referring the Court to the pertinent statutory provision in this case, which is set forth at page 1A of the appendix to our brief. That is the statutory definition of wages in section 3401A of the Code. It says that the term wages means all remuneration for services performed by an employee for his employer, including the cash value of all remuneration paid in any medium other than cash. Now, this broad statutory definition of wages, talking about all remuneration, is, in our view, consistent with the congressional design in setting up the withholding tax system in 1943 to collect income taxes at their source and thereby prevent what had theretofore been the losses of large amounts of revenue and to the Internal Revenue Service and the inconvenience of taxpayers having to come up with a large lump sum payment at what was then March 15th and which is now April 15th at the time of the filing of the return. Now, the regulations, which we set forth at page 3A of the appendix, similarly reflect this broad congressional design, because they provide, respectively, that the name that you call remuneration is immaterial, that is, salaries, fees, bonuses, commissions, and the like. And it also says that the basis on which the remuneration is paid, that is, it can be paid on the basis of piecework, percentage of profits, et cetera, all of that is irrelevant. The question is this remuneration for services by an employee for his employer? Now, the petitioner in this case has suggested that what we've done is to mix up things because this is not an income tax case. It's a withholding tax case. But necessarily, the code has to be read as an integrated whole, and we don't suggest that all items of income are wages. We're not suggesting that the gamut of receipts set forth in Section 61, which is set forth at page 1A of the appendix, all 15 items, which is not an exhaustive list, is wages. But we do suggest that the appropriate focus of this case is on Section 61A1. Of that definition, which provides that gross income includes compensation for services, including fees, commissions, and similar items. Now, there's no question, it seems to us, that these lunch payments here, really for the same reasons I pointed out...
Why do you focus on gross income when you've got a specific statutory definition of wages?
Well, we focus on gross income, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, simply because we think that the statutes dovetail each other. In other words, when we're talking about compensation or remuneration for services, and we're talking about compensation for services, those are really the same things. And what they do, in our view, is to emphasize the purpose of the withholding definition. That is, the purpose was to collect taxes on what is the employee's taxable base. In other words, that's why, in our view, the question of whether these items are the relevance of the Correll decision, the question whether these items are whether some of these items are deductible, and the fact that non-overnight lunch payments are not deductible is important, because what it demonstrates to us is that if the withholding tax system is to work coherently, it has to be a rough measure of the employee's taxable base. And in this particular...
Well, that would be fine if you're drafting the thing yourself, but Congress has already spoken. And am I not right in thinking that all wages is income, is gross income?
All wages are income, but not all income is wages. But this is a particular kind of income here, that is compensation for services. And it seems to us that under Section 3401, we're talking about remuneration for services... You have to ask the question whether these people got these payments for services. And that really corresponds to the Section 61A1 category of gross income. I don't mean to labor the point, but it seems to me that the two provisions work in a harmonious way.
You don't really need to make the
point. You don't need to make the point. But I think the code is attempts to be coherent, and that really was the entire point I wanted to make. Well, in any event, so what we have here, in order for the petitioner to prevail here, he has to demonstrate that these payments were not compensatory remuneration for services. And it seems to us that the facts of this case demonstrate the correctness of the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the payments were compensatory remuneration for services. First of all, these are employees. These people who work for the public utility. They were required to perform services. In exchange for the services that they performed, they became eligible for certain agreed-upon employee benefits pursuant to a union contract, much like the union contract in the Kowalski case. If they worked at their normal duty station, they got their wages. No doubt about it that those are subject to withholding, and the petitioner doesn't contend otherwise. If they went on non-overnight travel, they got their wages plus the $1.40 a day meal payment. If they didn't work for the day, if they performed no services, they got no wages and they got no meal payment. It seems to us that there is an inescapable causal connection between the receipt of the meal allowance, the $1.40 per day, and the performance of services. And in fact, there really is no qualitative difference between the meal allowance and any other element of the employee's compensation. That is, it's simply comparable to any other kind of economic benefit provided by an employer in order to get better services.
You can say the same thing about somebody that goes to a heated office on a cold day and works. There's an inescapable connection between working in that office and getting heat, but that doesn't necessarily make the heat a part of the wages.
No, it doesn't necessarily make the heat a part of the wages, but I would suggest that when we're talking about items like that, we're really talking about problems that are questions that are impossible to value. I mean, there's no, that's just not part of the compensation scheme in the way that wage, the normal salary, and plus lunch payment is for the day, any more than light or a pencil.
Then you're drawing a distinction between that which is capable easily of valuation and that which is not.
Well, it seems withholding system has to be a practical system, and I would think that perhaps the value of heat
if the value of heat went into the withholding taxable base, I suppose it might come out as a deductible employee business expense because the employee has to have heat to perform his functions properly.
Well, the employer deducts it anyway.
Yeah, the employer
deducts it. Mr. Smith, in today's life, haven't you heard secretaries want to know before I work, do I have electric typewriter, air conditioning, heat, et cetera? Don't they all say that?
Of course, and those are
part of their salary?
I would not think so. It seems to me part of the gamut of fringe benefits that an employer provides his employee in order to...
I wouldn't put it on grounds that you can't calculate it. I think you have to find another ground for it.
All those things do fall within the literal meaning of this sentence on page 20 that was called to our attention by your sister on the other side.
I suspect, well...
The water in the men's and ladies' rooms and everything.
I suspect as a technical matter they do fall within the sentence, but I don't stand on that. I'm not standing on that sentence. I think what we're talking about in this case is $1.40 a day cash payment to defray.
This is your brief trying to prevail on that theory, and this is what you tell us.
Well, okay. It seems to me that I think that sentence in the brief was addressed to refute the point made by the Royster decision of the Fourth Circuit, in which the petitioner has advanced here, that somehow when you have a payment that's not tied to a particular service, that it's not compensation for services, that it's not remuneration for services. But what the Fourth Circuit and Royster said on comparable facts is when the salesman ate lunch, they weren't working. But that can't possibly make any sense because vacation pay, people are at leisure during vacation pay, they're not working, and that's plainly wages subject to withholding, and I don't think the petitioner would contend to the contrary.
Let me ask you about one more concrete and readily measurable. A 15-minute coffee break with unlimited coffee. Today it's 25 cents, isn't it, for a cup of coffee? Average employee might readily have two cups of coffee. You're going to charge them 50 cents wages or for that?
I suppose it's a theoretical matter, but as again I point out that these are, you know, the withholding system is a practical system. You asked, I think, earlier in the argument about a Christmas turkey. The service has ruled that items like that, while technically income and quite properly also fit within the statutory definition of wages, are simply eliminated from both tax bases as a practical matter for ease of tax administration.
What about the western and southern states in the logging operations where lumberjacks don't usually live right at the site of the work? The general practice is that a bus comes around to the dormitory barracks where the lumberjacks stay, pick them all up at the same time, take them out and drop them off at the various work sites. Now, they get their travel to and from work, and of course they get all their meals and included too. Is the meals taxable? Is the bus ride taxable?
I think that as a theoretical matter, there is. They are all taxable.
Do you know what IRS is in fact doing on that?
Well, these are some of the problems that the Treasury is now considering in terms of there have been studies of the taxability of fringe benefits. And one of the things that the Treasury has to strike a balance between is sensible tax administration, which I would suggest I can't predict how the study will come out, but I would suggest it would exclude cups of coffee on a coffee break consumed by employees, but at the same time include in income more substantial items which are more easily susceptible to valuation and which are more regularly provided across the board on an industry-wide basis. Here you have a large public utility which simply decides that if a person is going to leave his normal duty station for the day, he's going to get $1.40 to eat lunch. And if he didn't get that $1.40, presumably he would have to pay for the lunch himself. From the Treasury's point of view, is a valuable economic benefit. So is heat, I suppose, but one has to one has to allocate one's resources in deciding what one is going to subject to tax and withholding and what it, one isn't.
Mr. Smith, I think you already answered the question I'm going to ask, but I don't quite have it clearly in mind. Let's assume that one of these employees drove his car 50 miles for his job site on a particular day and was provided reimbursement for his lunch and for his mileage. I recognize that Regulation 341A, et cetera, refers to travel expenses explicitly. Is that the basis for a distinction between the two?
No, because, well, in our view, I mean, that's your hypothetical with day work going back and forth and not going overnight. The way we read that regulation, the only way to have, and what the petitioner has tried to do is to turn this, what we regard as a lunch case, into a travel case.
Well, if you had the travel facts I stated, what is it?
Well, if you had the travel facts, if I had the travel facts that you stated and there was no overnight travel, those amounts of reimbursements would be remuneration for services, would be part of the fellow's total package of compensation. And there wouldn't be any offset under the regulation because there would be no...
The mileage would be compensation?
The mileage would... Sure, because commuting expenses. When one goes from home to the office and goes back at night, that under the court's decision, I think, in Commissioner versus Flowers, has long been held to be...
If you sent him down to Fredericksburg today, would that be analogous to commuting from Chevy Chase?
I suppose it would be different. If you sent him down to Fredericksburg on a mission for his employer, those travel expenses would be a deductible. If he got reimbursed for it, they would go in and out.
But not the meal he ate in Fredericksburg,
because that comes under the commissioner's overnight rule. And you don't, in other words, you have to eat your lunch anyway. The theory of the overnight rule, and it's a line drawing, which the court approved back in 1969.
Well, not overnight, he's going down in the day.
Well, that's right, Mr. Justice Marshall. If you travel in a non-overnight capacity, you don't get to deduct the cost of your meals consumed. That was what the court considered in Correll. In other words, if a lawyer leaves his office in New York, comes down for Washington to Washington for the day, spends the day debating with the IRS about a technical tax matter and eats lunch, that lunch is not a deductible business expense.
For the benefit of my brother Stevens, is any place in this record a list of the places in Chicago that you get lunch for $1.40?
Mr. Justice Marshall, I have two answers to that. To begin with, this case came from the Southern District of Illinois, where I hope that costs are cheaper. I think the district court sat in Peoria that decided this case, or Springfield.
I should tell you that the judges on the Seventh Circuit have found all those places.
And secondly, this was 1970. Now, I know that that doesn't seem that long ago, but it was 7 years ago, and I suspect 7 years ago one could get a modest lunch. And, in fact, the trial transcript talks about...
Well, do you remember when you could get one for $1.40?
Yes, but it's shrouded in the mists of time. In any event, we think that these were payments to enlist better services. They were payments to defray a personal expense. They don't come under the regulation that the taxpayer relies upon because they're non-overnight travel. And they do fit properly within the statutory definition of wages. Now, to the extent that...
Of course, the regulation doesn't say non-overnight travel.
No, it doesn't say non-overnight travel, Mr. Justice White, but the regulation, I think, was issued in 1943, shortly after Congress enacted the withholding provisions. The commissioner announced his overnight rule in 1940, And this sort of brings up the question of
Is this about the same? And in the Correll didn't involve this. Didn't involve wages. It involved income tax.
Correll involved
deductions.
And that was a long-standing Treasury practice that Correll.
Exactly. The court in Correll said that the commissioner had consistently adhered to this position
since
1940.
And that's the same time.
That antedated these regulations by a few years. These withholding tax regulations.
Yeah.
The commissioner's over.
Mentioned 1940 a while ago, though, as to.
Oh, well, I think the withholding tax provisions came in 1943 in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the commissioner's overnight rule antedated those.
As this regulation came out, he said it only covered overnight.
Well, I think it seems to me that's the purport of the phrase ordinary necessary expenses.
Well, I know, but did he have some rulings expressly, or?
There were no express rulings, but the point is that the commission.
Well, this is an awfully poor way of saying overnight, just to say all traveling expenses.
Well, the point is that the commissioner had been had announced the overnight rule is 37 years old. Now,
overnight rule for what? Not for this purpose.
No, for employee deduction purposes. But that brings up the point that I started with,
well,
and that is that
37 years old. It looks like he could have incorporated in his regulation.
I suppose he could have, but that brings up the point I mentioned earlier.
If he didn't, I would think he meant not to.
No, I think I don't think that you can. I would draw exactly the contrary inference that since the overnight rule,
you're entitled to.
Yes. Well, since the overnight rule involves Section 160, it centers on Section 162, using the phrase ordinary and necessary. It seems to us that the commissioner incorporated his position in these regulations, and in fact, since these things are not deductible. They don't fall out of the employee's tax base, and they are necessarily included in the definition of wages and subject to withholding. I don't think that the taxpayer can argue here that they weren't on notice that the commissioner was taking this position.
Smith, apart from this general language in this regulation and the Correll case, is there anything before 1969 that would reasonably have put companies like this on notice as to wages, that you can apply an overnight rule on withholding of wages?
Well, actually, I don't think the 1969 rule. The 1969 ruling said that if your reimbursements did not exceed your deductible expenses, then you had to withhold them. Or conversely, if they did, you didn't. That's what the 1969 ruling said. But what I want to say, in terms of the taxpayers' notice position, they've been arguing all along here that somehow there's a universe of wages, and then there's a universe of income, and that they have nothing to do with each other, and that somehow this stuff, while it may be income, are not wages. But when they come to their notice provision, they shift ground and talk about the fact that they relied on the Hansen case. And the Hansen case is an income tax case. It was one of the pre-Correll Court of Appeals decisions of the Eighth Circuit, which had rejected the commissioner's overnight rule. So they're coming back to the very position that we're taking on the merits, and that is that the withholding tax, that the employee's tax base is very important for determining.
Follow. That doesn't follow, because if there is an old case holding it's not income, a fortiori it would not be wages.
No,
but it doesn't follow that the change of the law on income is made, it doesn't follow that also the law changes.
There was an old case holding that
it was not deductible.
That it was deductible.
Well, it was deductible and therefore could be excluded from income.
Right.
But that the fact that was the law, the change in that rule would not necessarily also require a change in the rule applicable to wages.
No, I was simply making a point about that. My point was simply that the positions are inconsistent.
Well, no, they could rely on that because if it was deductible and therefore not includable as income, surely it would not be subject to withholding.
It is includable as income, but it is deductible.
It is includable in income. Yeah,
you have no point deducting. You don't deduct something that you don't first report as income.
Oh, absolutely. I understand.
Gross income.
I understand. Well, the point of the matter is that the old case or not, I don't think that the taxpayer, I mean, the commissioner had taken this position since 1940. And the fact that the courts were in disarray on this question of the deductibility of employee business expenses, I don't think that it's reasonable to rely on a single court decision. I think, as we point out in our brief,
seems to me... The other side of it, realistically, is you have large companies all over the country with problems like this, and they have no motivation not to withhold if they understand the government's position clearly, do they?
But it seems to me, when we're talking about an announced position of non-deductibility on the overnight rule, and you have these non-overnight payments, and you have this statutory definition of wages, and these items are plainly compensation for, or remuneration for services within Section 3401A. It would seem to me that a prudent employer and a large employer like a large public utility, if they had any question about whether or not to withhold, the prudent thing to do is to ask the Internal Revenue Service.
What, in fact, did the large companies do prior to 1969?
I'm not aware of any I can't answer that question because there's nothing in the record.
Any litigation instituted by the commissioner?
The only litigation instituted by the commissioner prior to this case was on the withholding point was the Royster case in the Fourth Circuit. So to that extent, I cannot tell you when the Royster case.
And that went the other way.
That went the other way, but it seemed, you know, but it also signaled to the tax bar that the commissioner was taking the position that these items were subject to withholding. And we would submit that the announcement of the commissioner's overnight rule indicated that these matters did not come out of the tax base. And that they were subject to withholding.
Excuse me, what is the date of Royster? It's in the brief, but I don't have it now.
Unfortunately, 1973. Although that's the date of the Court of Appeals decision. I assume that the Royster case began quite a good deal earlier than 1973. The Court has no further questions.
Do you have anything further, Ms. King?
I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.